Hello, you're listening to Spoiler
Filled
Film
Conversation.
Hooray! Yay! Woo! So,
That's a lot of enthusiasm to gather up for the film we're about to see.
yeah.
This
I
week,
think I'm in some kind of state of denial.
this week on Spoiler-Filled Film Conversation, we apologize humbly. We have quite the interesting film. I'm Richard Nicholas. Hello. With me for the chat is Anthony Evans,
How's it going?
Jamie Thomas,
Sorry.
and Abigail Bain.
Hi.
So this week's film of choice was picked by Jamie. Just Jamie, you can't blame any others. We just watched it. It's not our fault. It was picked by Jamie, and it is Exorcist 2, the sequel to The Exorcist. Actually, the full title of this is Exorcist 2, The Heretic, is that right?
Yeah.
I don't know if it has various titles. It matters not really. It's just Exorcist 2 as far as we're concerned. So, before we get into the what we thought and our reactions, what are the vital statistics, please, Jamie?
Okay. The Exorcist 2 is from 1977. The plot is a girl once possessed by a demon finds that it still lurks within her. Meanwhile, a priest investigates the death of the girl's exorcist. It was directed somehow by John Boorman, and again somehow stars Richard Burton, Linda Blair, Louise Fletcher, James Earl Jones, Max von Sydow, loads of good actors who ended up in this. I don't even know I don't know where to start.
I know it's got Darth Vader and Nurse Ratched and
Yeah.
well Tim Burton. Not Tim Burton. Why did I say Tim Burton? That would be more fitting. And Richard Burton,
Yeah.
it should
He's
be
the only big Welsh star into it.
It's just this thing that I'm trying to remember what the other film of this type was, where they had so many people in it who are skilled and good at their profession, and John Boorman as well as a director.
Yeah,
He is. And I don't understand how this went so badly wrong.
this is the guy who directed Deliverance. You know,
Did
and
I don't get
and it's not only
it.
that, it's a follow-up to such a phenomenal original film.
Well, this is the point. We should briefly say our expectations because
Yeah.
with all sequels, you have to bear in mind, perhaps, if you have seen the first one, what your thoughts on that one are. So, if everyone could say what they thought briefly of The Exorcist, and then what they were expecting coming to this film. Maybe, even if you'd seen it before, what were your expectations off the back of the first one? So, Jamie, you picked it, so what were what do you think?
Okay, I will explain here that this was a particularly painful experience for me because The Exorcist is possibly my favorite film ever. It's one of those films that the only flaw I find with it is that it's dated because it is. It was made in the early 70s. It's going to be dated, but other than that, it's like a textbook example of how to make a film, not only just a horror film, and I love it, and I could talk about it forever. And it was why I picked the Ninth Configuration, all
Previously.
that time ago, which is a sort of sequel. But so, I knew going in that this was known to be bad. I saw it back in 2005, I think. I bought the box set out of curiosity, and I watched it then and was appalled at how bad it was. And I guess I thought if I revisited it, I'd maybe been a bit unfair. Turns out I'd been too fair. And it was actually even worse. And as someone who loves the original so much,
Yeah.
this wasn't just a spit in the face. This was like being held down and having someone dribble on my face very slowly
You
over.
now understand utterly how I feel about the Highlander sequels.
Yeah.
It's exactly the same feeling.
Yes, this is very, very similar to how you probably feel watching Highlander 2. Because it's so just.
Why did you do this? This has nothing to do with the first. It's so different and wrong and bad on its own level.
It's just nonsense. Like the whole thing. At least the first. This is going to sound like a bizarre statement because of what The Exorcist is about. But it's an outlandish story told in a very grounded way.
Yeah.
Like, that's part of what makes it so disturbing for a lot of people. Is that
you mean
it,
the first one now?
Yeah, the first one. It's done in a very matter-of-fact fashion. It's not, like, an over-the-top, like, Hammer horror film or anything.
Yeah, they bring it down as far as you can, given the content.
Yes, so when crazy stuff happens, it's got, like, an edge to it because it's happening in this ostensibly real environment. Mm. This film just goes completely mental.
It's a bit more of a sci-fi as well. It's a bit more surreal and weird.
How does the hypnosis dream...
Hold on. Don't get ahead of yourself, Jimmy.
I can't. Oh, God.
We will get to...
Chomped at the bit.
We'll get to that and more. Anthony, what were your expectations and maybe your thoughts on the first one?
Okay. Coming in this time, I'd already seen The Exorcist... Or the original Exorcist trilogy before, because Jamie lent it to me many years ago, recommending at least the first and third films, and I agree with him there. There is something of worth in those two films, and maybe seeing them so close to The Exorcist 2, I was a little subdued this time as to my thoughts on the film. I remember it being terrible, but it can't have been that terrible, right, guys? There must have been something.
I'm sure we'll find the good somewhere.
So yeah, so I was coming in on the bat this time, similar to Jamie, I guess. That
we thought, I must have been too harsh.
Right, but you consider the first one classic 70s horror, right?
Oh yes, I'm quite I quite like the horror genre, and it is certainly up there with all the best.
Right on. Abby, what about you?
Well, I was puzzled that there was an Exorcist 2, because the Exorcist 1 had wrapped up in such a way that there wasn't anything to do.
Yeah.
The nice conclusion, you know, without getting into spoilers for that film, it concludes and there's not anything necessarily to carry on.
I'm going to spoil it. I'm spoiling Exorcist 1, listener. Spoiling it.
What, The Exorcist?
Both of the priests are dead. She's cured, so far as I can tell. There wasn't anything wrong with the mum, except that her daughter was possessed. And the cop had pretty much just accepted, I'm gonna brush this under the carpet. I'm quite happy brushing this under the carpet. I'm gonna do that.
I think if there was anything you could pick up from the first film and go, right, maybe the demon hasn't gone. Maybe it's still hidden inside her, but it's trying to be... Maybe it's trying to, like, hide and not get caught, and then it'll come out in later life. That is an idea they might have picked up in the sequel. And they kind of nearly almost addressed that, but then they got distracted with other things in this film. But I honestly watched The Exorcist recently, so I watched it before watching The Exorcist 2. I'd never seen it before. I knew about the plot because it's just in culture so much. And my first reaction to The Exorcist was just, oh, I get why this is important. It wasn't quite for me. But there was a lot I could respect about it. I think mainly I found the horror element silly, because maybe it's a dated thing. But just
I was going to say that's what I mean when it's dated, and it's been spoofed and parodied so many times that coming into it now for the first time would be really difficult.
But if you were like watching it at the time, you wouldn't know what was coming. The first cinema viewing of it would have been like great, I imagine, for the audience. And also, if you're 12. No matter, you know, when you watch The Exorcist, if you're like 12, this is going to give you nightmares for the week. You know, like, it would freak you out if you're like quite a young teenager, you know.
Yeah, I watched it for the first time when I was 13, I think. And it was my first proper horror film. Because I was a wuss when I was a kid. I was terrified of horror films. So I decided I was going to watch a horror film. So I watched one that was considered like the ultimate.
Yeah.
Because it was just because it was banned in the UK until like 99. And then it was released on VHS and in the cinema. And that's when I got it on VHS and I watched it. And I was blown away. And not just by the horror, but I really liked the story of Father Karras. And like, that's what hooks me, is his relationship with his mother and his loss of faith. Like, that is what makes the first one so good to me.
I always love a priest story. Like, in fiction, I find priests compelling. Like, they're just... I always love an interesting priest. And this has... It had priests by the ton as well. And some really good, interesting characters with depth. They play it a lot. They take it very seriously. It's quite... At times, I found maybe the first Exorcist I watched the extended edition, and it was maybe a bit too humdrum at times.
You see, you made a mistake there. You shouldn't have watched the extended one.
Ah, right. But, you know, otherwise, I thought I can understand it. I understand its importance and significance and its acclaim. It maybe isn't quite for me, and I did find some of the bits silly. And it kind of annoyed me, because it's like a movie you show... It's like a movie you show to go, ah, see, skeptics? You see, this is fiction. Yeah, but this is what happens in seances and things. People, demons are real. It's like, yeah, you can't show me fiction to prove it. This is a really good film, but I don't care. Being possessed isn't real. So it kind of... It fuels a generation of ghost hunters and, like, you know, The Exorcist is a cracking film, but it's had a big influence in movies, but also on people and their suggestibility to how the paranormal should work as well, I think. So it's an interesting film. But on to two, right? On to two, that's what we're here to talk about. The Exorcist was good. The Exorcist 2 is a sequel. What is it about?
I have a fundamental problem with The Exorcist 2. That pretty much started off all the other problems I have with this movie.
Go on.
And that's that... I've forgotten her name.
Reagan? Ronald Reagan?
Reagan. Reagan was absolutely fine.
As a character?
Yeah.
And they insisted that she wasn't well, and they messed with her, and started all of this madness.
Yep.
She was fine.
I'm sorry, I have to get this out of the way. They messed with her with a hypnosis machine that lets you leap into other people's dreams like Sam Beckett.
What both of us didn't get, actually, when we were watching it, is that when Reagan and the Doctor were in it, I understood that. But how were they still inside Reagan's head when it was the Doctor and Richard Burton?
Yeah, and why? Like, they bring Richard Burton in, and they sit this priest who they've just met down and basically go, right, you sit there and you leap into this teenage girl's mind. This traumatised teenage girl, you untrained priest who you've just met.
Well, the first time, he just insists on doing it himself anyway.
And, you know, that's the other thing as well, straight away. Richard Burton, Father Lamont, is the most unlikable main character priest. He's just... first of all, he's mad. Like, he's totally out of mind.
But he's obsessed with finding something wrong and evil about the whole situation, isn't he?
Yeah, but it's so non-specific.
Yeah.
He's just thinking about, like, the general idea of evil all the time.
And he's kind of the hero, and we're going to leap straight to the end of this. He's basically portrayed as, see, sometimes demons are real, and it isn't just people with mental illness. I told you, and I've saved you all from locusts or something. And it's just like, really? Really, you're the hero in this? You're mental and crazy and obsessed and a terrible, unethical man.
Yeah, that unethical is very much what he is the whole time. But so is Louise Fletcher, too. She's just meddling with people.
There's another thing with that machine as well. She has invented one of the most progressive machines in medical history, and she doesn't give a monkey.
She's just like, it's not that big deal. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, it's just a metronome with a light on top. I wouldn't worry. But it's like... Oh, and Richard Burton's performance in this is so bad as well. Like, it just the delivery of every line. And
I think he did the best of what he was given, and what he was given was terrible.
Well, apparently, according to IMDb trivia, he was drunk for a lot of the production.
He's probably trying to just understand the script, wasn't he?
Yeah. Anthony. You remember, and you must have been waiting for it when you watched it, because it was something that leapt out at both of us when we watched this for the first time years ago. Was there's a scene where Reagan draws the priest, and she draws him with fire around his head, and he sees the picture, and there's just this moment where he freezes, and then he just, I can't even do it without laughing, he just goes, the flames. Flames. They're getting bigger. And then he runs down into the basement of the building somehow.
Guesses.
That he knows what's happening. And there's a box on fire.
And he makes it worse by stamping it out.
He does everything wrong that you shouldn't do when you have a fire. Not only that, but like Louise Fletcher's character just goes off to fight to call the fire brigade for a small fire, and they seemingly tell her to go and get the fire extinguisher and put it out. And it's like, why did you need to ring the fire brigade?
It's like, she goes, what should I do? Get the fire extinguisher. Oh, okay, bye, click.
Ah, but you
By the time she comes back, like, he's just surrounded by flames.
Yeah. Ah, but you see...
I'm sure most of that room was metal, which doesn't burn.
The box had just got everywhere. And, but you see, guys, the really quick drawing she did seconds after being in the session, and so, I mean, she's a good illustrator, I'll give her that. It's creative and nice, but it was done instantly off camera, but it matched, didn't it? Because in the mirror, they were looking like there was flames on him, you see? The prophecy is right. You guys didn't get that bit because you all were thinking about the flames. You see? You didn't get it, did you?
Flames. There's another delivery as well that I had to rewind and watch again because it was so funny. And I think it's when he has the first hypnosis machine encounter with her, and there's a terrible, terrible flashback to Reagan possessed in the bed. Clearly not the same actress.
Yeah,
clearly
but,
not Mercedes McCambridge doing the voice.
Yeah.
And then she, like, there's a really weird moment where she, like, you see Father Merrin, who, fair play, they've done the old man makeup on him, and he looks like he did in the first one, and he's having a heart attack, and possessed Reagan is, like, reaching into Louise Fletcher's chest and, molesting her heart. Yeah. Oh. And then, but after that encounter, and they come out of it, I think she asks Richard Burton what he saw, and he said that he saw something, and I've written it down, and I remember how he delivered it, because as he says it, he looks directly at the audience. It was horrible, utterly horrible, and fascinating. And then he stares right into the viewer's eye. It was just, what are they trying to do?
I want to bring up something I liked, and it is to do with the start of the film. I find they're weird. They have some kind of care centre where Nurse Ratched works, and or whatever her character is. Like, she has a place for helping, I think, children with mental issues and stuff, and they have the coolest hexagon, unnecessarily hexagon rooms, and, like, sliding doors that are automatic, and instead of blinds, you pull a switch and it goes darker and makes everything reflect more. Yeah. I thought it was really cool. Like, if this was, like, a futuristic sci-fi, like, care centre or something, that would be the coolest room ever. It is a bit weird in the context, but I did like the room, and it meant you have a cool vision where things are reflecting. You have the people watching the weird experiment they do with their, where they do that mind thing, which was a bit, isn't that, Abby, you said it was like, what film?
Drifting in Pacific Rim.
Yeah, when two guys drift in Pacific Rim to operate the big robots. Like, it's just, they had put their minds together, like, so that it was like that. But they have the cool reflections, the kind of fantasy vision that they're seeing. Like, you've got several levels to, it's quite creative a way to direct it, I think.
That's the thing, though, it's like, this film, like, had it been by itself and not a sequel to The Exorcist, it would have still been bad, because it is a bad, it's a fundamentally bad film. But it would have at least been sort of interesting, because it's so weird. Like, it would have been more...
They could have detached it from the first one more. Yeah. And maybe have either made it make more sense, or made it make even less sense.
That's the thing, but because it's the sequel to, and it's a direct sequel to such a grounded film...
Yeah, more or less, yeah.
It's completely wrong. Like, it's as if, like, where does this science fiction element come from? Like, in the first film, all the scientific stuff is her having the lumbar puncture and all that stuff, which is done, horrific scene of the film. But it's done with that kind of clinical realism. Like, it looks like it's happening. Whereas this has got, like... This weird glass fortress of solitude for disabled kids.
Yeah. Kind of strange. Like, the thing with the first one is it's basically, okay, a phenomenon, the paranormal has happened. It's unbelievable and scary, but everyone, pretty much everyone, is skeptical. Priests are skeptical. Yeah. The mother finds a hard time dealing with it. The doctors can't find anything. And it's a last resort when they get to the more Catholic approach, like the ye olde Catholic stuff. But in this, it's like even though the doctor is it, who was the name of the character, Nurse Ratched?
Tuskin.
She is got this amazing machine that that no one can really explain, and she's skeptical, but it's kind of, you shouldn't be. You meld minds with people. You don't understand how amazing that is, and it also doesn't make sense because it's a blinking light that, like, can we just get to grips with what they presented as the gizmo that they meld minds with? What did they call
it? Box.
Synchronizers.
They synchronize minds.
So it's, what is it? Essentially, just two flashing lights
on a box
with a noise,
which would probably cause epilepsy in most people. And somehow this synchronizes two people's minds together.
But then, after they've been hypnotized, the weird thing I thought was really unethical and troubling. Even if you're going to meld minds and have the same memory or dream space, why shouldn't there be a, shouldn't like the doctor or whatever be watching two people? Or, like, you can't just put it on, take it off, and then put someone else in and take that off. There's no space. They didn't create a mind space. There was no object that was supposed to be where they were imagining. And then, extra weirdly, you put one person puts the other one under hypnosis. Then they switch to the other person to put them under and bring them into the dream space. Well, the patient has to do that. I just... The questions, the ethics of that.
Put you into a dream space where there's locusts and somebody screaming on the soundtrack. And I have to talk about the music.
Okay.
Oh, God.
Okay, again. This is another perfect example. There is so much talent involved in this film. Ennio Morricone did the score for this. This is the guy who did the music for the spaghetti Western movies. This guy did The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. He did Once Upon a Time in the West. He did Once Upon a Time in America. He's done, like, some of the most famous film music ever.
Did everyone in this, like, have a contractual obligation to make another movie for someone and just decided to all throw in on the same movie and get it done and out the way?
Well, I did read that the first script, at least, had some sort of goodness
talent
in it.
Yeah.
But, like, just over time, as I suppose this just happens with movies, more people get their hands in, there's rewrites, and then it becomes nothing like it started out.
It's almost like they've created a Pandora's box of everyone's poor, like, people who are talented. The one time they're terrible, they put it in the box, and everyone stored all of their anti-talent and closed the DVD case on it and, like, kept it in there for people to, like, unleash upon themselves.
Did anyone else have to almost turn the volume down at certain points of this film because of the screaming that was coming out of the soundtrack when we were flying over the plains of Africa?
It was more when they were... Right. Is it really the best way to get up to a temple to climb up inside a crag?
a good point. I understand that.
And when that dummy falls.
Oh.
And he keeps bouncing off everything.
We basically have two locations to talk about. One is the lab where it seems a priest can come in, bully his way in, take over an experiment he doesn't understand the equipment, and unethically team up with a previous victim of some kind of demon possession.
Or mental illness.
That's the thing, which he absolutely believes. There's no scepticism in Lamont at all.
Yes, but he saw the creepy scene that happened, so he believes it even more now. So it's fine. And we have Africa, where there's some kind of unrelated plot that they tie in to do with some kind of some kind of Africans who are suffering from the locusts, which are real. I mean, locusts are real. They are a problem for people trying to farm, but they're just a natural thing that happens.
Yeah.
It's not some demon-possessed thing.
Yeah. Okay,
I don't know if I should spend the rest of this podcast just going, what about this thing that didn't make sense? Can you explain that to me? Because we're going to be here for days.
The thing is, there are ideas in here that come from legitimate places. The exorcism in Africa, carried out by Merrin, is referred to in the first film, where they say he's had experience. That's why they get him in as the exorcist, because he's had experience before, and they say an exorcism in Africa damn near killed him. And the Pazuzu thing isn't in the first film at all, but it's in the book. The demon is named. And they, I guess, picked that out and decided to run with it. But not run in any particular direction. Just run around in a circle for a long time and then fall over.
I already have a metaphor for this film.
Go on.
It's an ant's death circle.
An ant's death circle?
Oh. But there's this thing that happens with ants where...
Wow, hang on. I'm going to buckle up for this. What?
There's like a leader ant that will put down the scent that the rest of the ants will follow so they know the way. But sometimes the ant will accidentally cross over somewhere it's already been. And then all the other ants will just go in a circle endlessly until they all die.
Ants. I thought you were talking about ant and deck.
No.
That's reasonable. But for a minute there, I thought you were going to suggest that ants had some sort of kind of fight to the death in like a
Coliseum.
Yeah, I was thinking, okay, the film has affected Abby. We have to exorcise her. Well, not exorcise. exorcise, however you say it. But yeah, maybe it's like that. We'll hold off on metaphor. We haven't even got to what it's about because it's very hard. But
that's the thing. I thought I'd say it then just in case we didn't make it to the metaphors at the end.
Just in case we all die before the end of the
podcast. In case Abby rage quits trying to get to grips with the ins and outs. But basically, the idea of having a look at a previous exorcism is okay. It even makes sense that it's in Africa and it ties into a locust plague. I don't like that it suggests that locusts are somehow sent from the devil. I mean, they're only insects. They're only behaving in evolution-like terms. They're just surviving and that's how they work. I don't know why we have to demonize them quite so literally.
Once the bad locust brushes you with its wings, then you all become bad locusts, except there's a good locust or something, or what?
Ah, I can sit really. But you're right, Abby, there was a temple up a cliff that they travel up the crevasse of a cliff and hide there when there's a dust storm. It's all very pointlessly dramatic. Well, it would be if it was made sense at all. What did you guys, Anthony, what did you make of the whole African link and tie-in to The Exorcist 2?
You mean the clearly studio sets that they were trying to fall off as Africa?
That's the place. That's the one, yeah.
Do you know what it looked like? It looked like an old BBC TV production of Macbeth.
Yes.
Ooh,
like, yeah.
So,
that's
not
out of the question. That's what they did.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I understand. It makes kind of sense to go there in a kind of story-making and filmmaking way. But ultimately, the only knowledge he really gains from going to Africa is that locusts are bad when they rub against each other. And it's couldn't he have learned that in a zoo?
And didn't he sort of play it up a bit to Reagan later on as well? He kept saying, I heard this and I was told this. It's like, no, you weren't. We were there. You're lying.
Well, it's confusing because
what are you talking about?
They go there in a dream space. They have visions and stuff. Because once he's had the weird experiment once and their minds have a kind of ESP again, you don't need the machine anymore for plot convenience, that they can have flashbacks and they can dream there. But also, Richard Burton's priest character goes there for a bit and they don't like him because he basically says, well, I flew here with a demon once. That's how I knew where the corpse of a long-dead child was. Well, we hate you. But it's really just, it's really confusing because it just, that you don't know when, you kind of know when they're having a dream or when they're not. But it why go there physically and also arbitrarily go there in your dreams with Reagan? Sometimes Reagan is going there. Sometimes it's Richard Burton.
What's going on when he finds James Earl Jones's character, who is, okay, Kakumo was the kid in the village who would banish the locusts with his swinging whistle thing. Yeah. And he got possessed by Pazuzu and Father Merrin exorcised him. And then Pazuzu's the demon that comes back to Reagan in the first film and Merrin has a showdown with him, dies, whatever. So Kakumo's grown up into Darth Vader. And
yes.
Richard Burton goes to Africa to find him. Finds him in a little temple with spikes in the floor dressed as a locust.
Or does he?
Yeah, that's the thing. He, like, and
well, no,
he falls into...
Let's not gloss over the fact that the voice of Darth Vader was sat in a chair dressed as a giant locust. Amazing.
And then he says, you know, if your faith, if you have real faith, which has never been doubted,
yeah,
at this point in the film, if you have real faith, you'll step over the spikes and get to me. Richard Burton steps on him, his foot's impaled, he falls face down, and then he wakes up in a lab that he's found somehow.
Yeah.
Has he just, like, sleepwalked into a laboratory and they've
yeah,
let
because
him in?
James Earl Jones acts like
he knows him.
He's been absolutely fine. Like, he's just walked in the door, he's shaking his hands, all kinds of things. The receptionist doesn't give him monkeys.
No.
What,
this guy's
what
on the
is
floor.
He doing?
Well, like, I know Richard Burton was frequently on the floor at this point, but...
like Reagan, he's grown up fine after the exorcism. He's just got a regular job, he's moved on with his life, and he's borderline sceptical of the whole thing. So it seems anyone who's had an exorcism doesn't really have any negative repercussions. You know, like, it's not... I think the whole time, Reagan and this guy, the witch doctor... Well, no, not a witch doctor, he's...
Kokumo, yeah, the scientist. Yeah.
He's... They're both fine, and it's only when, you know, a mad priest turns up that they have any problems.
Yeah. That's the thing. Like, the priest and Tuscan, both, like, Reagan, like you said, does seem fine, and they're both meddling really hard to make her not fine. Like, no, you must remember. Come on, you must remember something. Remember that really traumatic experience that you went through when you were 12?
You've suppressed it, we'll have to crack it open and get it out so you can deal with it.
Yeah, re-traumatize you all over again. Remember when your head turned all the way around? Oh, that was weird.
No, I don't. I'm just happy doing illustrations and my tap dancing is going well. I'm in a show.
I'm happy fixing disabled children. No. Come on. Let's put you in an asylum.
Yeah, that's a weird thing you mentioned. They imply she has some weird gift for helping. Like, there's a little girl who's also in the center with Reagan, and she just starts chatting to her, not realizing she can't speak or hasn't before. And eventually the girl manages to stutter out a few lines, and she somehow miraculously cures her and makes her speak. It's like, well, I could have just spoken to that little girl. Like, you know, she didn't do anything. Like, the girl spoke.
It's this weird kind of... I guess, yeah, it comes up at the start of the film when, again, Father Lamont is in Africa carrying out an exorcism where a girl burns herself to death, which is never mentioned again.
A little bit of a flashback, but no, it's not relevant.
But is he... Like, in the first film, they talk about how the Catholic Church never do exorcisms unless they, like, are really pushed. Like, they barely even believe it themselves. Yeah. So why is this priest going, like, a door-to-door exorcist? Like, what's going on here?
Then... They made it sound like Merrin had done a lot more as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, but Merrin's like,
their guy.
He's almost like an embarrassment to them. Like, they look at him as like, oh, yeah, Merrin, you know, he's a crazy old guy, goes all over the world, you know. He did an exorcism once, supposedly, nearly killed him. But, like, they still... There's a lot of weight to the idea of an exorcism in the first one.
It seems like there's a cardinal who's sent the guy to investigate it, even though, you know, the police must have gone over it and, you know, must have concluded something. But we'll send a priest well after the fact to go, was the priest up to something weirder? And then when he does find it, oh, yeah, it's well weird, Richard Burton comes back and he's like, oh, you wouldn't believe some of the creepy stuff that's going on with this girl. Oh, yeah. Well, maybe don't investigate anymore. I want to investigate it now. That's kind
that's
of what happens.
Well, late, like, towards the end of the film, Father Lamont brings up something that has never come up before in the first one or the second one and isn't really referenced again. Apparently, Merrin believed that we were all moving towards some kind of hive mind and that we would all be one consciousness, but that it could go one way or the other and it was going towards evil. And what? When did Merrin ever even suggest that? Merrin wasn't some kind of, like, existentialist. He was a priest.
And quite a sober one as well. Like, not a weird, crazy one.
He was one of the old school ones.
Yeah.
He just sort of sits around most of the time writing stuff down. And then when he does need to do things, he very quietly prays and does incantations.
We're not talking about a raving loon. We're talking about a man who calmly collects himself and goes, do you know what, this is weird, I've done it before, I'll sort this, but it might be a challenge. Like, he's quiet, he's not, like, not this loon who had weird conspiracies, and they make they pull so much out of thin air in the sequel. You're kind of just left going, you're insulting science and science fiction on the one hand, and then the insulting story science, on the other
science
one.
They're insulting science fiction, religion, and the original movie.
And fiction.
I was going to say it's so bad that they're not just insulting the original; they're insulting abstract concepts vaguely related to it.
It's like you've invented ESP, and then you've betrayed it by going, "Well, sometimes with ESP, when one person gets hurt, the other person feels it, and they fall down too." And it's like, well, how come that never happens anywhere? Like, how come Reagan isn't thinking everything you're thinking all the time? Why is the one... Like, there's no consistency with the rules of the made-up nonsense they come up with. Everything they set up that's science fiction-y in a bit, run with me here. They can, you know, have a dreamscape where they meet. They kind of meld each other in a hypnosis. And then they instantly betray everything they establish. And then they do it again and again. And they have stupid stuff just like... Reagan has a dream and she wanders out to like the edge of a building for some tension. Even though I don't know why there's a window. Like they have a really high up skyscraper that doesn't have safety rails in certain bits.
I was going to say, yeah, did George Lucas design their apartment? Because not only is it all like silvery and white, it has no safety rails over massive drops.
Yeah. What I was going to mention is I watched another movie recently that was... wouldn't pick what powers it had as its thing. Oh, it was a movie called Dead Birds that was about...
I've seen that.
Terrible, boring horror film, clichéd.
Yeah, it was rubbish.
And I had the same thing with this as I did with that movie, where it's like, no, pick the thing that your thing does.
Yeah,
because in the first Exorcist, it was sort of... it was related to bodily function most of the time.
Yeah,
and
it's a possession. It's just simple. There's a demon in you. It's having physical traits on you, but more importantly, you're possessed by a demon, and it can affect you. There are inconsistencies a little bit in The Exorcist, I'd say, but they're subtle ones that are sort of not a big deal.
Whereas this was just like, oh, we have this thing, but this thing can also be this thing, and this thing can do this thing too.
Yeah.
No, forget the first thing that we did. Now it does this. Now
that extends out like it balloons to the rest of the film as well. Like it's so thematically inconsistent. There's no, like the first one is about like the struggle with faith and belief.
Mm.
This one's
not about anything.
I don't even know. Like it brings up stuff like that, but like completely at random.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, like it does contain all of these little nuggets of like philosophy and theology, but it just brings them all up out of the blue and seemingly nothing to do with what's going on.
If it would just pick one and follow it, it might be all right.
Why? Also, I just remembered when they go to I guess a hotel room or an apartment or something and hypnotize each other again for no reason. When Father Lamont just gets up and walks out the door like a zombie, they just leave the machine in the room.
Yeah.
That thing's really important.
Although it isn't, because sometimes they have ESP anyway and can just think... they can think
so
what each other are thinking.
Do it at all?
Did he turn heel after that? Because it did seem the whole time he was just like, no, I must get her to the room. Which is like the last place she should be.
This is the only time the film really, really confused me, was this last third.
Yeah, because I did not know what was happening.
Yeah, because you just don't understand the motivations of the characters. Like, Richard Burton's just going off after this last synchronizer thing, and you don't know, is he possessed? Is he doing this off his own steam? And even though, like, Reagan's following him and trying to talk to him, it still seems like he's possessed. But then at moments, it's like, no, he is clear of mind, he knows what he's doing. But, and then it just goes crazy, you don't know what's going on or why anything's happening.
He takes her all the way back to Georgetown in Washington, all the way back to her house.
Also,
somehow Tuskin and Sharon know they're going there and follow them.
But he doesn't really, because he just leaves and she follows.
Yeah, she follows and she phone calls them, and they turn up. But also, the room in the first one, it wasn't that the room was haunted. Reagan was staying in the room, and it was a problem. I mean, there was a bit of weirdness with the bed, but fundamentally, this is a room where death's happening. It's where the incident has happened. But it wasn't like, it's a haunted house. It wasn't a haunted house story. I'm not 100% why Reagan was the one to be possessed. I thought it was going to tie in with the weird artifacts found by the priest, but...
They did try and say in this movie that it was because she was a healer, and Pazuzu tries to possess healers because they do good.
Even though she wasn't doing anything healing in the first film, she just, you know, was a child.
She's a little girl. Yeah,
but the room is such a misnomer. It's nothing to do with the story. The room was where something horrible happened, but it's not, like, if anything, Reagan is the person you need to see. That's where you need to go, is the girl who was a vessel for a demon, essentially.
It would have made more sense if they'd have gone back there because the spirits of the priests were there.
Or something.
Or something.
That's another thing as well. Sorry.
Go on.
Carry on.
Yeah, the spirit of the priests, plural. Karras has one brief mention in Exorcist 2, and he's not even named, and then he's brushed aside.
Why doesn't he matter? He's the more significant priest of the two anyway.
Yeah, if there was, like, a main character in The Exorcist, it was Damien Karras.
He has a whole narrative arc. He's an interesting and developed character, and he's also the hero of that piece, in a way.
But nobody mentions it. They say, oh, there were two deaths here, and that's it.
One was outside in the window. And there was also another death, but never mind that one as well. It seems to just utterly... Like in the same way that Highlander 2 misses exactly what Highlander 1 was about. It just sort of goes, I don't know about this. I've had some ideas that I want to crowbar in here. Never mind and reason and being a fan of the first one.
Why did the PA kill herself?
Because they needed a character to turn evil.
Yeah, like for a minute.
Like who? Was she a character from the first one? Was she helping?
Yeah, Sharon.
I thought she was the older sister or something, but she was just a personal assistant.
Yeah, it's Reagan's mother's PA.
And she turns all freaky at the end and decides to weirdly commit suicide or whatever and be really weird. I thought if it was a sister, it could have made sense because, it's maybe passed on genetically. No, she's just someone who also got infected by the bad stuff and then turned nasty at the end so that, scary.
Yeah, pretty much.
And after just surviving, like, the most horrible car crash.
The silliest most horrible car crash for no reason.
They should have all been mushed to pieces.
Feel sorry for the taxi driver. He got squished. But yeah, that's the thing, is it would... Wasn't that... There was also, like, the car crash happened, why? Because they came near to the house? So, the demon smashes windows? I don't really get it. Occasionally, objects could be moved by the demon in the first one. And there's not much rhyme or reason, but it's sort of, you know, a kind of ghostly thing to do. But
It always has that conscious drive behind it. Like the bit in the first one where the drawer opens and Kara says, did you do that? And the demon says, yeah. In this one, like, the demon has these, like, overarching powers where it can... It's almost like the Omen, where it can suddenly influence things completely unrelated to it, that are completely outside it.
Yeah, that's why I didn't understand where it was anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it wasn't in her.
Yeah.
And... It wasn't in him, far as I could tell. It wasn't in the house.
No, and before. It's completely missing the point. Like, the horror, part of the horror of the first one was that this demon was inside this little girl.
Yeah.
Whereas in this one, it's in a swarm of locusts, maybe? I don't know.
And it's not like it has infinite power when it's in Reagan. It can, within her space, it can control her a bit and it can affect the room around her and things. But it's limited. Otherwise, it's a pretty rubbish demon if it couldn't. Whatever it was motivated, it wanted to be, disturbing, but...
Yeah, its whole thing was to terrify and traumatize people by making this girl do horrible things to herself and then ultimately kill her.
Yeah.
Whereas in this, it's an assassin that goes around destroying healers with locusts or something.
Yeah, it had no reason for, you know, you needed a motivation for anyone in this film, and it lacked so much with everything, I don't know.
I want to talk about the big finish now.
Okay, go on.
What was in the bed?
What do you mean?
Because it looked like Reagan, but Reagan was by the window.
It was the only way they described it was Pazuzu's Reagan. So somehow Pazuzu manifested itself as a clone of Reagan.
Yeah. Oh, what?
As a kind of, but not just that, as a kind of weird, not an incubus, succubus, because it was kind of like drawing him in and making him like kiss her and stuff.
And he's so rubbish as well. He just goes for it straight away.
I mean,
he's just like.
In no way was the first one about some kind of succubus, weird clone ghost thing. The whole thing is the demon is in Reagan. It's using Reagan as that. That's why you need an exorcism to separate them. After the exorcism, it can't just be a disembodied ghost that looks like Reagan. It is something else, and it has to be in something else. Or like, what are the rules? You can't have them throttling a ghost version of Reagan from a childhood.
It completely contradicts the idea that like in the first one. They experimented with loads of different types of makeup for Linda Blair. Mm. And, like, the initial thing was to make her look more and more demonic and inhuman. Mm. And in the end, they decided against that. And they had that, like, most of what happens to her comes from illness or self-injury. That's so, it. Like, all of her... Yeah. And it's because the demon has no physical form. And it manifests through injury and sickness. Mm. Which is, again, that makes this film make even less sense because now it's suddenly embodied in a version of her with yellow eyes or something.
There isn't a problem if there's a separate monster. You don't have the dichotomy of we want to destroy the demon, but an innocent girl is tied to it. In this case, there's an innocent girl version of the demon, like monster thing. They're separate, so it's no problem. We just burn the house down with it in it, bit of holy water. But no, it decides we have to physically stop a ghost monster thing. What? I don't know how even writing that on the script would read. When you read it again, you're just like, oh, that doesn't make sense.
The fact that he goes from like almost having sex with her on the bed to throttling her and then pulling her heart out.
How do you... Since when... So a demon that doesn't take physical form most of the time is killed by pulling its heart out. What?
Yeah.
What?
And then it falls down the stairs.
Just what?
And since when is like okay, again, coming back to the first one, the huge like act of heroism with Karras happens when he pulls Reagan off the bed and just punches her, which is such a simple act.
It's not the act of a hero. It's not sacrifice, it's not noble, it's not clever.
No, I mean there's no magic or anything involved. He loses it and he physically attacks and then he tells the demon to come into him and throws himself out the window. It's all physical. It's stuff that happens.
Yeah.
Whereas suddenly Father Lamont, who's this kind of doughy middle-aged alcoholic who like reaches his hand into the chest of a 16-year-old girl and pulls out her heart.
It's not even a cool like Sub-Zero finisher. It makes no sense. Like I know it does. Like you know, with horror and science fiction, they're not going to make sense. But there's obeying the rules of your fiction and obeying like the logical fallacies of like you know, well, if we've created this, it would work this way. But it seems to. It doesn't even bother to make up a rule to break. It just sort of...
It's taken
all of the rules from all the different supernatural beings and used them at random.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because, like, with the heart thing, it reminds me of the sort of stuff... Well, I don't think Van Helsing has ever really almost slept with a vampire and then killed it. But the kind of thing is that you have to deal with hearts. You have to take the heart and you have to destroy the heart.
Yeah.
But with this, it's just, oh, what do you do with demons? I don't know. What do they do in the other films? This?
Yeah. It's just whatever you've got, we'll have. That's fine.
Yeah, and the whole time, they've got these little styrofoam balls being blown at them by a big hairdryer, which is supposed to be locusts.
We have somehow part of the room is torn away into, I don't even know, another dimension. Yeah. And they just sort of walk off into the other sort of weird realm. Yeah. And
what I liked about that was the house like collapses for no reason at all. The house completely collapses.
Yeah.
And then Father Lamont and Reagan decide they're going to go off into the sunset. So they walk over the wreckage of the house. If you paid any attention to the way that street is set up, there's a steep set of steps down the other side of that house. They just walked off the edge of a village.
Into a... But into some kind of unknown landscape that we don't even understand.
Yeah. That's not Washington over there. What is happening?
And I guess, well, it's all burnt in the fire, so we'll never know what really... No. You can't just end that way. You can't. They're not heroes that walk off into the sunset having defeated the evil demon. They're a well-adjusted girl who was possessed or mentally ill when she was younger, and a crazy, crazy priest. You're not heroes who can walk off and go... What, are they now traveling to a new universe to stop more demons? What are they doing?
It's not even a mentally healthy young girl anymore. It's a girl who's been manipulated and warped by a mad old priest.
Yeah. But that's okay, because Nurse Ratched's there to keep it a secret and have the realization that, like, oh, yeah, I guess sometimes science is wrong and demons are real. That's the message. That's kind of the message of the first one, is, you know, sometimes there really are evil demons, and in a way, the old Catholic ways are right. But that's something, that's a message I don't necessarily agree with, but it comes across well in the first one. It's like, sometimes the paranormal is real. This one says, sometimes the paranormal is real, but it makes no sense whatsoever.
That's the other thing as well. Like, until maybe the very last line of the film, nobody has a character arc. Like, nobody goes anywhere until, like, the last 5 minutes where they all, like... Tuscan, like, realises something, but it's not very clear. It's basically that, yeah. Oh, science was wrong all along. There's demons and locusts or whatever. And what's Lamont learnt?
I'm right.
Yeah.
Always go with your lunatic instincts and be as unethical and just investigate things you're not supposed to and meddle.
Don't do it properly, yeah.
Meddle in people's lives, be absolutely irrational and crazy, and assume that a perfectly healthy young girl is related to demons in some way. I mean, I don't know why it wanted to tell that story. Why would you want to do an Exorcist sequel other than, like, that? Like, what was the motivation? Other than money, what was the reason to tell that story?
It honestly seems like someone went, I really want to make a sequel to The Exorcist.
I had
someone
crazy
went, okay.
ideas.
Well, no, that's the thing. They went, okay, what's your idea? And they'd gone, oh, I hadn't actually thought about it that much. And then the whole time, they kept, like, making notes, but never actually stringing anything together. And then someone came back and said, is it ready? And they went, yeah. And just, like, handed the notes over to John Borman, who I guess was resting on his laurels after Deliverance or something. I don't know. I can't, like, I see nothing in this film that makes any sense in terms of why anyone wanted to make it at all.
Yeah, baffling.
Or there's that saying of nobody goes out to make a bad movie. They don't get up in a day and say, I'm going to make a bad movie today.
Apart from the Asylum production team, they do do that.
But I can't, there's no point where somebody was making this and going, do you know what, we're doing some really good work.
Yeah. Like, no, but that's my explanation as to why, like, the performances of, like, Richard Burton and Louise Fletcher are so bad. Because they must have just been filming this and thinking, why am I in this? This is awful.
Well,
but again, the potential cast for this, just looking at the IMDb trivia now, John Voight was nearly Father Lamont, David Carradine, Jack Nicholson. Christopher Walken? Can you imagine what this would have been like if it was exactly the same film, as just as bad as it was, but with Jack Nicholson playing Richard Burton's role?
Or Christopher Walken. Just, I kept this artifact up my... That's terrible, Jimmy. This film has already lost... It had so much failed potential. You can't add to it by the what-ifs and could-have-beens of what could have been cast. That's not fair. It already loses so much credit.
And I think the response to the film when it premiered is perfect. Like, is what it deserved. It was laughed off the screen at its premiere.
Literally, they laughed so hard it came off the screen.
William Peter Blatty went to see it and had to stifle his own laughter. William Peter Blatty is the guy who wrote the book and the screenplay for the first one, and he also directed the third one and the Ninth Configuration. But yeah, he laughed all the way through. William Friedkin has never seen it. Yeah, they were the production team was singled out by the audience at the premiere. Somebody turned around and went, "The guys who made this are in here right now," and they had to. They quietly got up and left.
They should have had an exorcism on the production team.
It's like, I think the guys who do the Razzies, this is in their like top 10 worst films ever. So it's not even that it was a bad sequel to a great film. It's considered one of the worst films
ever made.
And fine, because it is. It's absolutely terrible.
I feel bad because normally we would champion mediocrity or try and find the good in something. Yeah. But it's even Super Mario looks good by comparison to this film.
You know, I was about to say, I am the guy who, you know, think of the films that I've chosen for this podcast. I have Super Mario Brothers, Rock and Rule, Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome, and I have kind of defended them all.
But I think you owe us a formal apology.
This explains
you a little bit as well. Sorry, we keep clashing there, and I do apologise.
No.
But this does explain you a little bit, like, the curve of the films that you watch. If this is the worst, then no wonder you're so sympathetic to some of the other films that you watch.
I love, cinema and film so much that I am very forgiving.
I think it's interesting, though, that one of your favourite films is The Exorcist, and then right at the other, all the other films in the world are in between it and The Exorcist 2 for your appreciation. All of cinema is in between the quality of the two, and it's the next story to be told about an exorcism.
Yeah.
Amazing.
No, that actually makes perfect sense that my taste in film is bookended by by two, like, different ends of the potential spectrum.
Before I say, is there anything else that we want to talk about and mention from the film? I would say my last problem with it is, well, there's many problems I've probably forgotten, but it's called Exorcist II: The Heretic. Now, there's not an exorcism in it. There is no exorcism.
There's also not a heretic, so far as I can tell.
No one's really being a heretic, are they?
Is it supposed to be Merrin? Is it supposed to be Lamont?
It's not clear. There's heretic, but I mean, no one's denouncing Catholic beliefs or anything. Exorcism itself might be a taboo, and therefore the act of a heretic, but it's not. It's a bit weird. I mean, a bit awkward.
The problem you would have with it, though, having an exorcism in it, is that's what happened to the third one. The third one is, I think, has potential for a film bin podcast and might be a good, like, palate cleanser for this. But, again, it's not a great film, but it's interesting and it's at least more entertaining than this.
It seems like the logical step for a sequel.
Yeah, and
much more than
it's also like the third one in its own way is very much is a lot weirder than the first one and a lot less grounded, but in the same way the Ninth Configuration is, because it's the same director. But anyway, that film ends with an exorcism that doesn't make any sense. And the reason it does is because the studio said, this is a sequel to The Exorcist, you have to have an exorcism.
That wasn't the mistake they made with 2, though. I mean, that's a mistake. They have references to exorcisms of sorts, like in flashbacky what's going on things, but it's not a clear we know what's going on thing.
But the title of neither film is The Exorcism. It's The Exorcist.
Yeah, but it should have...
Like, the first one is about, like, oh, who is it? Is it Karras? Is it Merrin? We need an exorcist. Whereas this one is, like, I guess it's kind of about Merrin, who was the exorcist from the first one. I don't know. I'm trying to defend something here that is just indefensible.
So we've talked about the big problems. Are there other bits? I'd be glad to hear anything we have to say. We thought something was interesting or good about it. Anthony, you haven't had much of a say, so is there anything on your mind?
Grasping at straws. What you were saying before about the kind of the institute that they were in, like how that was designed. I suppose, now that I think about it, it's kind of designed like a hive.
Yeah, it's sort of thematically linked.
Yeah, so...
Oh, you've actually just discovered some merit in The Exorcist 2.
Well, at times...
I don't know. I think really, I'm thinking hard, and that a set, one set, is the only thing that I can find any good in this film.
A set that looks a bit like a Doctor Who set from the BBC in the 70s.
Yeah, and seems more at home in like A Clockwork Orange than this film, maybe.
Yeah.
I think the trouble is, there's loads of things that give me good ideas for a sequel. There was bits where I was like, oh, if I was doing this, I'd have it be a battle of wits and mind between... If you're going to go with a weird, like, hypnosis thing, it's all, you should make it all about the therapy sessions and the priest trying to get out that... Maybe finding out that Regan is actually evil and it isn't just a demon, it's her. But she covers... Because she is happy and nice all the way through this, and his goal could be maybe to find out the real truth, that it's secret inside, there's still a demon there, but she's happy in the hero, and they don't do that. And there's things where, you know, science versus religion is something they could have tackled more. They could have even looked into the story with the locusts in Africa in a better way. I kept having good ideas that the film didn't think of, and just it would just keep going and just go, what? So it had it had the spark for ideas that it didn't capitalize on all the time. Which isn't a very good positive thing to say, but you know, I'm reaching. Abby, you mentioned you didn't really mind Richard Burton's performance.
I think it's because all the performances I've seen of Richard Burton have been where he's just been Richard Burton.
Well, he's the best thing in the quite poor film Candy, which is bizarre and surreal and odd. And he's amazing in that. I like him as like a performer. I think he's hilariously like Shakespearean in his approach.
I think to me it was clear that he was the one trying the least, yet he was still the one coming off as the best actor.
Yeah.
I mean, I
don't know
how
to describe it. It's like, clearly he was not invested in anything, and yet just merely because he is Richard Burton, there is something there.
Yeah. I don't think it was a terrible performance generally. No one was doing it. Like, it wasn't like, this is a bad movie because it was bad acting. It was literally what they had was drivel. No one stood out as being, oh, they didn't know their lines, or they didn't, you know, everyone was doing fine. It's just, it made no sense. It was a bit, also, seeing Rogue, like, having seen them next to each other quite recently, seeing Regan grow up and then be quite an attractive young woman, it's like, oh, I feel weird because you were a demon a minute ago as a child, and now you're quite attractive and you're lovely, and why can't we just do a rom-com about you? Do we have to revisit that nonsense? I don't know. Abby, is there anything else you want to talk about, bring up? Anyone, you know, if you've got other things we might have missed?
I don't think so. Richard Burton was the only thing I enjoyed in this movie, and I think it's just because he's who he is. Everything else just either disappointed me or dismayed me.
Baffled. Angered, baffled, confused. Yeah, all of those words, isn't it? Jamie, come on. Search your mind. You're a big fan of The Exorcist, so you must like something.
One good thing. Max von Sydow was in it.
Yes.
I can't think of... like, and he wasn't, like... He didn't seem as into it as he did in the first one, but he wasn't, you know... He was serviceable, and he was present. And that was... I actually didn't think Linda Blair was particularly terrible.
No.
No, actually. She did okay.
Considering that she was, like, you know, 16 in this, I think, and... it was terrible. She did a decent enough job, but it doesn't matter. it's like, whatever good thing you can think about it, there are 100 other absolutely terrible things.
It's almost like you could give it a second watch to find the things you didn't notice you had a problem with before. There must have been problems within the African exhibit in the museum. That elephant looked a bit suspicious. I'm not sure about that taxidermy there. But, like, you know, like, generally, it was just... you can't defend a movie that bad.
I don't think I can think of another film with so much talent that is so irredeemable. like so many talented people doing such terrible things. Like, again, coming back to the score, Ennio Morricone just made noise for this film. Really, really annoying noise. Coming off the back of the first film with Tubular Bells.
Yeah.
You know, which is like iconic now as a horror theme.
It is.
Because of its use in that film. And it's like kind of eerie and spooky and it's perfect. And then you just have weird shouting in this. Oh, God.
So, rating system, guys. What could we rate this in terms of?
Well, I already said my aunt's death circle, so I'm sticking to that.
When ants accidentally kill themselves. has anyone got any other... I mean, you know, I'll accept any kind of vague metaphor instead of, you know, numbers.
This is the filmic equivalent of the plague.
Of locusts.
I can't think of anything else. No, just the bubonic plague.
You see it coming from far away, but you can't stop it happening.
Yeah. Oh, it just... I really can't think of anything to compare it to. Like, it is just purely its own thing.
It is the worst of the worst. And it's, I mean, it has nothing to compare to.
You know, like, right. When the first film came out, it was very controversial, and with some people, with some religious groups, they said that it was an evil film, which I don't understand, because in the end, like, you know, God wins, basically.
Yeah. It kind of makes a strong point for Catholicism.
Yeah. And, but
they had swearing and throwing up and horrible stuff.
But people said the film was like cursed and it had like the devil in it or whatever.
They enjoyed it correctly. They were terrified by it as they were supposed to.
I would say the second one is if cursed. God was to seek retribution against mankind for making The Exorcist, The Exorcist 2 is his retribution.
That's a good analogy. I think I like that. It is. I'll take that. It is the demon sent. It's just retribution, isn't it? It's you like this horrible stuff that's an insult to me. Then I give you the sequel.
And
the cursed child of the Exorcist.
Perfectly apt punishment because it is a punishment to watch.
It is very much Reagan at her worst. Like when Reagan is most cursed and at her most horrible in the first one, when she is really being tortured by this demon and killing off priests, that is what this movie is, and it needs an exorcism. We need someone to sacrifice themselves. Jamie, I'm looking at you. You need to take the spirit of the movie into your body and jump out of the window or whatever and kill it, and you need to erase it from everyone's memory so we can all move on.
I watched this a couple of days ago to prepare, and then yesterday I hadn't planned to, but I ended up watching The Exorcist just to make myself feel better. And it says a lot that, you know, The Exorcist is a film to watch to make yourself feel better after a certain experience.
So, you know, is there anything left to say? Or do we...
Sorry.
I have a question that isn't necessarily related to the podcast, so it may get edited out. But if Jamie's spectrum is The Exorcist going all the way across The Exorcist 2, and mine is Highlander going all the way across to Highlander 2. What are your guys? What are your ones? Do you have a movie and its sequel as two ends of the spectrum?
So a treasured movie that's one of our favourites and a sequel that went, do you know what? I hate everything you love and I will mutilate it and make it look wrong.
That's basically what this is. Well done.
I'll think.
That's your metaphor.
Do you know, Anthony? I mean, what... Is there any example? Because it's hard,
isn't
it?
You might not have one. It might just be coincidence. It's Jamie and I both have one.
It happens with directors. Like, I quite like the films of Robert Rodriguez, but then his children's films are the most appalling dreck ever. But I don't think that's quite right.
No. I'm sorry, okay. I can't think of any sequels.
Like I said, there might not be one. I just wanted to put the question out there in case there was. I found it interesting.
Maybe we can muse on it and come back to it for another spoiler-filled. Sometimes we're like, well, this is a film that betrayed my love. Oh, I don't know.
I don't know. Maybe... I don't know.
It's hard. I can't think of one off the top of my head.
Has anyone seen the Ring remakes? The like American Ring remakes?
No, I haven't seen the sequel, but I know it's like notoriously bad.
Personally, I prefer the American redoing of the Ring. I think it's like one of the best remakes of like a foreign film I've ever seen. But then number two comes along, and it is so mind-numbingly bad. Also, The Return of Jafar.
Oh, shut up! Shut up! Talk about a great film with a really good sequel. Oh, no, that's not the same though. That's not like a this isn't, you know. The Return of Jafar can't be at the end of your worst movies ever.
No, because at least The Return of Jafar makes some kind of sense in and of itself.
Yeah, it's the straight to DVD cash in thing, and you know, whatever. Like, it's hard to think. We're gonna have to obviously not say what they are. We'll obviously probably cut this because we haven't got a good analogy.
Oh, it's a good idea for a future podcast topic.
I don't ever want to do Highlander 2.
I don't know.
No.
Oh, what about the Blues Brothers and Blues Brothers 2000?
Oh, the trouble with that is, for me, that could be yours, but for me, the Blues Brothers is quite low down anyway. Like, it's nowhere near the top. So it's like, Blues Brothers 2000 is awful, but Blues Brothers, you know, I don't like it that much. It is good in a way, but there is a good divide, though.
Speed and Speed 2.
Oh, wow.
Cruise Control.
Hey,
Speed 2 was a boat?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But then Speed can't. It's one of those things, you know.
Whose favorite film is Speed?
Okay, I've got it.
Right,
American Psycho and American Psycho 2.
That I haven't seen the second one, but you're right in that American Psycho is brilliant. So if the sequel is terrible,
it's a similar thing. It's like it's a sequel, but it's got like hardly anything to do with the first film.
Isn't William Shatner in it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh. It's just a different story about a different psycho who happens to be a girl. Who
it's the Supergirl of the horror comedy franchise.
Yes, I kind of recommend watching American Psycho 2 just because how bad it is.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, you know, I think that's probably a good example. That's more the right sort of
area. I may even go as far to say it's as bad as The Exorcist 2. But at least it has William Shatner.
Yeah, because that'll save it. I guess something weird is like The Brave Little Toaster is not a brilliant one to champion. I love The Brave Little Toaster. The second one is poor and rubbish, but the third one, right, is so weird. It's already a weird premise, but I love the third one because it's so, what are you doing with this?
That's kind of like The Exorcist. Like, the first one is great, the second one is terrible, and then the third one is like great in a really bizarre kind of way.
Yeah, but with the Brave Little Toaster 2 is just like, I don't know why it's about saving pets in a, you know, in a vet. Like, it just doesn't do it. It's not terrible. So I can't think of one that's quite right. I'll have a think about it, though. So maybe I'll come up with a really good one as well. So I guess, you know, we're all going to wander off into the inexplicable background that wasn't there before as the house collapses around us.
Actually, I'm going to go and throw myself down a long flight of concrete steps.
Thank you, Jamie. Thank you.
As retribution.
Don't forget to eat the DVD as you do it. But yes, we're going to go now. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Evil.
What was with that? Like, that was a really good impression. Oh.